The movie theme from Gene Pitney. I'll tell you a story. I was working at NBC5 doing the 10 o'clock news. I'm in the newsroom one evening in 2006, and I see that Gene Pitney has passed away, and I stand up, and I say to everybody in the newsroom, "Oh, my, Gene Pitney died." And people are giving me a look like, "Who?" And that's when I realized I had entered the second plateau. we're going to talk about Gene with the author of a book, Gene Pitney, the singer, the songs, the songwriters, David McGrath. David, I know you refer to him as the reluctant rock and roll star. And why was he reluctant? And also, why does he seem to be the forgotten guy from that era? He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He had a string of hits leading up to 1970. He never stopped touring until the day he died. He was huge, maybe bigger in other countries than here. It's kind of a mystery, isn't it?
First of all, thanks for having me here, Bob. I think at some point Gene was his own worst enemy, just in his personality and his makeup. He did not always want to be recognized, did not always wanted to be part of show business. He wanted to be Gene Pitney, Liberty Valance guy when he was on stage. Mm-hmm. When he got back to Somers, Connecticut, where he lived, he wanted to be Gene Pitney, the guy who could fix a septic system, or the guy who went to the post office, or the guy who went grocery shopping. And he just didn't want to be bothered with that. And he never wanted to be part of that scene. Whew, boy, that a 1960s term. That scene, for example, he had more hits than Engelbert Humperdinck and Tom Jones, but he never wanted to be on TV. He never wanted to host his own TV show, so he never got that kind of fame like they acquired and like Tony Orlando acquired, because he was just happy living that quiet little life in Somers, Connecticut.
He wrote Rubber Ball, Hello Mary Lou, and He's a Rebel for other artists. He had 16 top 40 hits, 4 top 10 hits here, and he was even bigger in the UK. And back to that theme from Liberty Valance, that never made it into the movie. How come?
So in my book, you'll find out there are about 4 or 5 different versions as to why it didn't get into the movie. And I, in the beginning of the book, I say, first of all, these memories are 60 years old. So that song itself is about 60 years old. So, Bob, you and I are about the same age. So try to think back 60 years and come up with specific details. And sometimes they're a little blurry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Gene has one story. And they're all just variations on a theme. So Gene has one story. Burt Bacharach, Hal David have another story. The bottom line is, Hal David always said it. He's the guy who crowed. He wrote all the lyrics. Burt Bacharach did the melodies. Hal said, John Ford, the legendary Hollywood director, this movie had Lee Marvin and John Wayne? I don't know. Marvin and John Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
The director, John Ford, said, I don't want a crummy pop song in my movie. So you can write it. It's not going in the movie. And that's what happened.
That was a giant hit.
Yes. Well, and then so Hal David always say, I bet you John Ford wishes he had that in the movie now, because the movie became a decent selling movie after the record came out.
Yeah, interesting. Let me play a little bit of That Girl Belongs to Yesterday. And there's an interesting story about Gene Pitney and the Rolling Stones. This was written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richard. It was actually their first hit, wasn't it? They weren't on it, but it was the first song that hit from the Rolling Stones, wasn't it? And Gene sang it.
Yep.
I was alone and feeling sad.
Now, what's the story? Pitney was at some early Rolling Stones recording sessions.
So the linchpin here is a guy named Andrew Luge Oldham. And back in the early 60s, Andrew was a jack of all trades, master of none. He was a publicist, and actually he was doing publicity for Gene on that tour. But he was also trying to be a record producer and a manager, and he was involved with the Rolling Stones to a pretty big extent. He was their manager at that point, and he was trying to produce records for them. And Gene was a star at that point. Gene had already had 1 or 2 hits, maybe 3, and so they were doing a TV show in Birmingham, England called Thank Your Lucky Stars. And Andrew said, why don't I get Gene Pitney and the Rolling Stones together? Maybe we can make some money and make some magic. And the Stones had been writing songs. They really wanted to do R&B and blues stuff, but they had dabbled with some pop stuff, and Andrew suggested they show Gene 1 or 2 of their songs. And a song they had called originally My Only Girl, they showed him. The track was already done, and Gene said, well, give me the track. And can I change the melody a little bit? I think you've got something here if we can change the melody a little bit. So, you know, again, now Mick and Keith, now they're struggling at this point. They're not stars, or they're working little clubs, you know, 35, 40 people. They said, fine. So Gene took it for 3 days, kept the track, and changed the melody a little bit, went into the studio, did 2 takes on it, and put it out. And it was, again, because he was so big in England at that time, it went into the top 10 very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't do as well over here, but it was the first chart hit for the Rolling Stones in the United Kingdom. And after that, they started to take off.
One of the interesting stories in the book, Gene Pitney, the singer, the songs, the songwriters. More with David McGrath coming up momentarily about the great Gene Pitney, who died way too young at the age of only 66. We're talking about the legendary Gene Pitney with the author of a new book on Gene, David McGrath. Gene Pitney, the singer, the songs, the songwriters. David, this song was his biggest hit, wasn't it?
This song was his biggest hit in the United States, and it's a great record written by Hal David and Burt Bacharach again, but it's a dilly of a story. He didn't want to record this song.
Why?
So what would happen was Burt Bacharach would go to the Music Core building. Gene was at Music Core Records, and Burt would go there and play the songs on the piano for Gene. And Burt could sing, but he didn't have a great singing voice, like a lot of folks, but you know, he had that special oomph that songwriters put in the song. And Gene said, well, that's a nice song, but I can't record it. Burt said, why? He said, it doesn't have enough words to it. So I actually went and counted the words. There are 116 words in that song. However, Bob, as you notice, the chorus opens the record,
mm-hmm.
and then it's sung 4 more times. So that chorus, Only Love Can Break a Heart, Only Love Can Mend It Again, is sung 5 times. So that's 60 words. So we'll give him credit for 12 of those words. So if you subtract 48 words from that total of 116, you've got like 68 words in the song. And just to compare and contrast, a couple of weeks ago, I went and I pulled out Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. He's got 86 words in the first verse.
How did you get obsessed with music and obsessed with Gene Pitney?
Oh, gee whiz. So I grew up on the east side of Milwaukee. And at St. Peter and Paul, a Catholic school on the east side of Milwaukee. And the coolest kid in that school was an Italian kid named Tony Logi. You know, he had the olive skin, the wavy hair. He's good looking. He could talk to girls. Me, you know, I'm lumpy from Little to Beaver, Leave It to Beaver.
Uh-huh.
So, and I would walk to school with Tony every day because he would walk past my house. So at one point he said, you know, this Gene Pitney song, it was that song, Only Love Can Break a Heart. It's a great song. He's a cool guy. So if the coolest guy in my school thought Gene was cool, then of course I had to think he was cool. And then when I started listening to his records, you know, they just grew on me, and I liked him a lot. I liked the songs a lot. And then that British invasion happened. You know, you're old enough to remember that. And Gene maintained his star status through the entire British invasion, one hit after the other. And that fascinated me. And then I started to stalk him.
Uh-oh.
I found his parents' home number in Connecticut, and I would talk to his mom all the time, Ann Pitney. Yeah, Dave, I'll give Gene your message. And to advance the story, when I was working at Channel 12 up in Milwaukee, he calls the switchboard one day as he's heading to England on a tour. He must have been stuck in an airport. And he called me just to say hi, because I had been talking to his mother. And then the relationship advanced slowly but surely. And then back in 1983, Bob, I'm replacing the floor in my kitchen up in Kenosha. And the phone rings again. He says, Dave, this is Gene Pitney. I said, yeah, sure. Okay, what do you need? And he said, no, really, this is Gene Pitney. I need your help. And what he wanted me to do was, this is long before the internet, he needed somebody to run his fan club. His sisters had been running it out of 2 little boxes on the kitchen table. He said, I need this because this is how we get tour information out. This is how we announce our new records. We need fans to lobby DJs to play the new Gene Pitney song. And then that led to merchandising on his American tours. And that relationship grew exponentially, both business-wise, and then we became personal friends. And he was best man at my wedding to the lovely Gwida Brown right behind me here in 1998 in Kenosha.
And you're still working in Kenosha Radio, right?
I am. I'm a news director at a public radio station up there.
Now, we talked about this earlier. Is this the one he did on the Oscars?
He did.
He was the first, was it the first pop star?
First pop star. Now, Johnny Mathis had sung on the Oscars before, but it's a slightly different genre. So, real quickly here, so he goes out there, now he's 20 years old. He's a small-town kid from Rockville, Connecticut. And now all these stars are sitting in front of him, Marilyn Monroe and Clark Gable and all these folks. And Bob Hope is the host. And before the show, the producer says, "Now, Mr. Pitney, what we want you to do, we built you a set, and you're going to walk out on this set. You're going to do the first verse at the top of the staircase, and then we want you to walk down the staircase, but don't look down at the stairs. Please look forward at the audience." Now, Pitney is thinking, I'm going to fall on my face figuratively and literally here, because nobody walks down the stairs without looking down the stairs, especially with, what, a billion people watching on TV and every major Hollywood star in front of you. So he was petrified. But he did it, and you can see that video on YouTube. That's up there. You can see that. And he did a great job. He lost. His song lost to something called Moon River or something like that.
A little ditty.
Yeah, and he always said, "Can you imagine my career if I had won that Academy Award?"
Lots of great stories in the book. Gene Pitney, the singer, the songs, the songwriters, David McGrath. I had the thrill of meeting Gene for an interview I did on television with him, and I remember asking him, "Why are you so reclusive?" Because that's the reputation you have. And I remember Gene saying to me, I don't know how that got started. I think one interviewer had trouble finding me and printed that, and then everybody picked up on that from then on. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Bob. Amazon.com?
Amazon.com for the book about Gene Pitney.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much.
A legendary and unfortunately, I think, forgotten rock legend from the 60s. News next at 9 from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.